Conciliums with Pete and Charlie.
I'm Pete.
I'm Charlie.
The unity of knowledge.
That and a whole bunch of caffeine is what's going to get us through this.
So what makes a really good teacher?
Oh, crap. You would have to ask me a hard question. You sandbag me on this one.
This is not a hard question. It might be a complicated question to answer fully. It might be a hard question to get the truest answer. But you and I both know what we think is a good teacher.
Yeah, and the first requirement, I think, is one of motivation. If your motivation is to actually teach students, make them more knowledgeable and skillful in a particular area and more excited and passionate about it, which I think goes hand in hand, if that's your motivation, you're already off to a good start. I mean, everything good is written on a coffee cup. And I think it was, the quote ended with, a good teacher inspires, right? So that's the higher, level taxonomy of what a teacher does. But if you're there, I mean, the problem is, and this is definitely true of university education, they're there just because it's their assignment. They're there, and some of them are there just to torment you. They really are.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you about. Not the torment, but we'll get to that. There are a lot of research faculty here, right, who have to teach because it's part of the job description, but that is not why they got the job.
Yeah.
They are not motivated.
And some of them actually teach less and less nowadays.
Yeah. So how does that work? I mean, is that – I could tell the story that Georgia Tech is full of people who teach just because they need to have the money for their lab. But I don't know if that's true.
Oh, no. And there's some really big-name researchers who bring in a lot of research grants who are actually excellent teachers and highly motivated.
Do you think they started as teachers and then became big shots? Or do you think
I think they might have been big shots for quite some time, but they've always embraced the value of teaching. So I have colleagues in chemical engineering that have really big research grants who embrace teaching, who put in an effort to really care about it, which is good. And then there are others here and anywhere. This isn't unique to Georgia Tech. Could not give a crap about teaching. When I was at Illinois, Harry Drickamer, who had a joint appointment in physical chemistry and chemical engineering, did not care to teach undergraduates. And he used to give a speech, and I don't remember the exact words, but it was told to me many, many times by my fellow students who took him, that was kind of like Eddie Murphy in the movie 48 Hours when he went into the cowboy bar.
I think you've told me about this.
Yeah, it's the, I hate teaching undergraduates. You people are undergraduates. That means I'm really going to be enjoying this without the expletives that he put in there. Meaning enjoying torturing you.
Yeah. So I don't want to teach. That's not a thing that drives me. You know,
teach. Sorry, I just whacked the microphone.
We almost had a horrible event in the studio.
A sugary drink.
I don't want to teach. I have taught, and I've gotten high marks.
You seem like a nurturing fellow in the classroom. Oh. And I don't mean like in a bad way where they report you to the state.
What do they call
the SIO survey? I forget what
the SIO survey, the survey of teacher effectiveness and likability and all that stuff.
Right.
I've gotten high marks. You know,
I believe it.
And nice comments.
And that's just because of those hipster boots you're wearing right now.
They're not hipster at all. These are very old-fashioned.
Very hipster.
And that's a small sample size.
Right.
Except it's not. It's every student I've ever taught.
Yeah. But what do you mainly teach? Do you teach GT1000? What else?
So I've taught let me start again slowly.
And now, Charlie Bennett.
I've taught GT1000 twice, mm-hmm. and I've begun teaching it a third time. Mm-hmm. I was a co-instructor on a literature survey, mm-hmm.
Survey of literature?
Seminar, a literature seminar, literature of work. I was the embedded librarian in a major authors class. I didn't really teach in that one, and mm-hmm. I didn't get evaluated as a teacher. And I was consulting faculty on a couple GTE 2803 courses.
Is that the transfer student version of GT1000?
No, that's the design education. The thing that Ray Vito was trying to do with Wayne Lee.
Oh, yes, exactly. Innovation and design.
Yeah.
Good stuff. I've given some lectures.
Your idea, your invention.
Yeah, and I've done some workshops for that. It's a great course.
So those, where I was consulting or on the fringe, you know, embedded or, you know.
I like that, embedded. It sounds like you're hiding in a foxhole in Fallujah.
Well, it totally came from the embedded journalists, I think. Let me retract that statement.
Is backwards, I think.
I can only think of the embedded journalists in Iraq when I hear embedded librarian.
Yes, that's what I was thinking of. That's why I imagined you in a foxhole in Fallujah.
But I mean, when was the first time someone said embedded librarian?
When I got one stuck in a boil on my left calf.
Very cute.
To me, embedded is a medical term.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the kid's got a Hot Wheel embedded in his nostril.
So I teach pretty good, right? But I am terrified of the live teaching experience. And I say live as opposed to recorded, right? Because that's how I think of my life now.
Okay.
I give presentations, you know, and I do performances, and I'm jacked up when I do those, you know.
To me, teaching and performances are the same thing.
Yeah, that's interesting.
That's probably not a good way to go.
I feel a lot more controlled in like an improv. So I did these two improv performances, the Armando at the Village Theater
in
Atlanta.
Yeah.
And
you provided the inspiration for the entire evening.
Right, I told stories on stage alone, and then stepped off, and then let the improv team come on. So, all of the sort of terror things are there. I was alone on stage. I didn't know what I was going to say. Mm-hmm. I was trying to make people laugh, you know, and I was more comfortable there than I am talking to a bunch of students.
Why do you feel the students will turn on you like a pack of dingoes?
I believe so. I mean, I once
sometimes they do.
I once almost lost my shit in a meeting with faculty, teaching faculty members over at Emory, because I misspoke, you know, and by misspeaking I was presenting to them one thing and they were taking another thing. In particular, this guy, because this guy says I don't know that I want to, you know, have my students play these podcasts for people outside the classroom. And I said, well, I don't think the audience matters.
Oh, this is when you were giving a talk about using podcast recording as a teaching tool, which I did. We did a podcast one year. I loved it. I thought it was a great idea.
But when I said to a literature professor or a writing professor that I didn't think the audience mattered, it was kind of disrobed in front of the class. Like it was the wrong thing to say, and it definitely lit them up.
What you meant to say was not that the audience you think you're talking to doesn't matter. It's that sometimes you can perform better when you sort of forget about the audience.
Yeah, yeah. Well, even more so, I thought it doesn't matter if anyone hears these.
Oh, right. This is an educational exercise.
Yeah. And in fact, it would even be cooler if someone outside heard him and said, oh, that's what they're doing at Emory. Whereas this person, I think, first was expressing concern that someone might just stumble upon the work that their students were doing in an uncontrolled environment. Right?
They might have used a bad word.
More like his name would be on student work that was not very good.
Well,
I think.
That's why they're learning.
Anyway, so you refuse to empathize with this professor.
Actually, I forgot the year that we did this, and I'm having trouble jamming in 2 days for presentations. I've done videos in the past. I think I'm going to do the podcast thing again.
Oh,
and my
yeah.
class is at 3 o'clock today. Bam!
That's teaching in action.
Because let's be honest, video cameras, you still got to worry about a little bit, but now everyone has on their phone. But audio recording, you guys agree on what they're going to say. They sketch it out, and they click the button, and they upload the sound file.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's no barrier anymore for this.
It just means you have to listen to them.
No, but what's nice then is we can do one day. What we'll do is I'll have myself and all my team leaders listen to them. We'll pick the six finalists that we think are really good. We'll play those. We'll have a discussion of what we learned from those and others. And then I'll give out, like, you know, free T-shirts to the best one. It's nice to give a little prize. Am I wrong on that? It's like the teacher that brings in candy.
So I had a terrible time for the rest of that presentation after I essentially went against common sense.
I saw this. This was a presentation you gave to faculty at Emory.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember you talking to me about this.
Yeah. So.
No, but I agree with you. It doesn't matter if anyone other than the instructor listens to it.
Yeah. But
I would like to have the other students listen.
That part's unimportant. Okay. The point is that I got, like, terrified. I thought I was going to wet myself, you know.
Oh, wow.
Just because of the nervousness. But, like, up on stage, I played live music, and I'm not a very good musician, and I was less nervous than I was
in front of people. Live podcasts. So
all that to say, like, teaching, to be motivated to teach is kind of crazy on top of wanting to be an academic, which is sort of stupid, right? So you got a crazy, stupid person, you know, who wants to...
I can't really disagree with you in my
connect
case.
With young people.
And I will confirm this in front of my students this afternoon.
Right. I mean, so I don't really have a point. I don't really have a question beyond, you know, like teaching is magic and teaching is awful. Why is it that people persist?
Because it's magic.
But it's awful.
Well, you think it's awful. I don't think it's awful. Nowhere am I more comfortable than in front of a bunch of students. And when I do stand-up comedy, and maybe this is to my detriment, I took a 25-minute set recently that I did up in North Carolina, opening for my good friend Tim Lee. And I realized my set, it was one of my better sets. So somebody was trying to hire me to open for him at some guy's 50th birthday party. And he goes, send me a thing. So I gave him a new tape. It was from 2015. Because it was a really good set. I got a lot of laughs. But my comedy is always educational, and my education is always funny. And I'm actually looking in via a National Science Foundation-sponsored grant. Can the funny help you teach technical things like engineering? And truth be told, everyone just makes this claim. Oh, funny is better than not.
I feel like you've been telling me over
it could be quite distracting. You need to do it the right way.
Funny is not really great.
But some of the funny I do is to, one, keep the students awake. It's tough. This is difficult material. It's easy to lose focus. And two, keep me awake, because oftentimes I teach at 8 o'clock in the morning. So a little bit of fun just gets the blood pumping. But it's not as effective as you think. We have students here at Georgia Tech who are like, look, quick, enough with the jokes already. Tell me what I need to do to ace the test to get an A.
Right.
But they don't care about the material. The students that are older that are like, well, this is fascinating. Tell me more. They like the jokes. So I will admit this. I'm probably going to get in trouble for this. But so I'm making videos for my mass and energy balances class. This is a very class I think we talked about last time, where this guy at Kansas State sandbagged everyone and then told them all to change majors.
That was last episode, right?
Yeah. I did this sort of as practice to get the video recording system down. And so chapter one in this book is what some chemical engineers do. And they're trying to do something very important, which is tell them, you don't just all work for an oil company. You can do amazing different things. You can work in business. You can work in sales, technical sales. You can do all sorts of neat stuff. You can work in government service, you know. And so I said, this is what the chapter is doing, and they give you some great examples there. And then I show them statistics of the different areas of industry people work, so it's very diverse. And I said, let me do what the first chapter does, give you some explicit examples. And I talked about how you can work in microelectronics, right? We always think of that as a electrical engineering issue. But much of what we do to make the chips that you use in your cell phone are chemical. So, and then the other one I used was, we are applying chemical engineering to things that 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago didn't exist. So pharmaceuticals, right? I mean, at the turn of the last century, you know, we had a few basic things. But, for example, one of the biggest contributions of chemical engineers was being able to make antibiotics like penicillin on a large scale. So that pharmaceutical application didn't exist when chemical engineering started. And I took a much more recent one, which I think is going to be big, and that was because of my involvement with these guys filming this TV pilot about cooking with cannabis. Its medical applications alone are amazing, and there's lots of chemical engineering that is and can be applied to extract and separate and deliver compounds that may have tremendous medical benefits for people, regardless of your moral view on it.
Your colleague, Mike Filler, is doing a podcast called Nanovation.
Yeah, about his cool stuff in nanotechnology.
He had Matthew Ralph on it.
How do you say his last name? We've had Matthew on our radio program twice.
Matthew Ralph is
the I quote Matthew all the time,
He's the kind of guy that just by bringing him up now, I'm thinking, really, he should be doing this podcast without either one of us.
Probably.
He should just...
I quote him all the time. Yeah. I think he's a Renaissance man.
And he was describing... Well, one thing, he was describing carpet recycling. Mm-hmm. That was one of the things. And you saying, you know, these things didn't exist 50 years ago. I was like, no one recycled carpet,
Didn't, right?
But now they figured out. And, you know, he's talking about how to approach the question of how do you recycle carpet, right? And he was delivering this sort of worldview. And it was so explicitly, you know, a system of thought that could be applied to, let me start again. At the core, it's something that we all should have. It's like, you know, how do you take in the world? How do you think of the world? And what are the questions that you want to answer? And what are the values that you want to embrace? Mm-hmm. Right? And that's like, everybody has to figure that out.
Right.
Hopefully. Yeah. His were, you know, this sort of chemical engineering system of, you know, approaching things and figuring out how to minimize waste.
Yeah, system-level thinking is what Matthew does.
Yeah. And so he's got a way that he thinks of things, that he approaches things. And so then if you slide carpet in front of that way of thinking, then he'll, you know, dismantle the process and ask his questions. So in my mind, teaching or education, right, as opposed to training... Education is getting people in a place where they can understand, here's how you engage.
Yes.
Here's how you engage a personal life. Here's how you engage a professional life. Here's how you engage, you know, your thought and your spirituality. Yeah. And, you know, here's like
so Matthew,
thinking.
Mike, and I like to think myself, we teach problem solving.
Yeah.
And that can be applied in a lot of places.
Well, Michael Lauder said that, you know, the only thing that companies really pay attention to when they're trying to hire you is if they can make money off the questions you're going to ask.
That's a good way to put it. Certainly in research, that's true.
Like, and he's talking to Georgia Tech engineers, so that's how he's, you know, structuring it. But, you know, and that's a pretty good thing to say. It's a bit reductive, but hell, so is everything else. So, how are you going to ask questions? And really, how are you going to ask questions that help you become happier? How are you going to ask questions that help you be kinder or more empathetic? How are you going to ask questions that are going to make you money? How are you going to ask questions that are going to make other people money? How are you going to ask questions that are going to find you the path to fulfillment, right? These are the things that we want to teach.
Sometimes the question is, you know, why do we do it this way as an engineer? Why can't we find a way that works better? Or in your life, why am I so miserable? And if so, why am I continuing along the same path?
I watched a lot of movies and I read a lot of books for a long time. Like just a tremendous number. Sucked them all up.
I agree. You have read a lot of books and seen a lot of movies.
Now, here's the thing, though. When I was young and dumb, right, or younger and dumber, I just consumed those. Like they're just in my head. And I can still remember... at kind of my worst 20s, dude, bro, what's up, man, kind of way. When I was just quoting movies, you know, and like reciting the occasional paraphrase from a, I guess you don't recite a
but
paraphrase.
But there's tremendous sage wisdom in a movie.
Absolutely. Except what I was doing was I was just regurgitating fragments of things I had read or seen instead of letting them sort of inform some kind of central core, right?
Right.
These days, you know, if I listen to I listen to Matthew Ralph's guest spot on Nanovation, Mike Filler's Nanovation, and I, which I recommend.
Yeah. Mike's a neat guy. I've had Mike speak in my GT1000
class. I'm on it
class.
Twice.
He's a very Renaissance dude.
Yeah.
You've been on the Nanovation podcast?
Twice.
What do you know about nanotechnology?
Nothing.
Fascinating.
So, when I listen to Matthew Ralph talk on Nanovation, instead of sort of memorizing the way that you approach carpet recycling, which I think is what I would have done 20 years ago. Right.
Oh, yeah.
Just to have it to talk about it or to be. Instead, I heard what he had to say and I started thinking about, oh, how can I try to approach my professional identity a little bit more like Matthew?
But when you're a freshman, you're not as cool and collected as you are. You're thinking, what can I memorize and regurgitate on the test to get an A? And they don't see the forest for the trees.
And training is, you know, memorization and practice, right? Like actually doing a thing over and over
again.
Well,
I think you have to – you're right. You have to practice problem solving, but problem solving is a very open-ended creative endeavor.
Think of baseball.
I try not to.
It's a simple game, Pete. You throw the ball. You catch the ball.
You hit the ball.
Right? Except then when you think about Moneyball – which was a film, but also a book about a person who used what is the name for that field, the analytical field that they sort of brought to Moneyball.
But it was basically big data analytics taken to Moneyball.
Yeah, they did that. They did
which
data.
To me is like an engineer. I'm glad I made that movie because this is really a movie about nerds.
They made data driven decisions about who to get on the team instead of saying, "Oh, this is the guy."
We sometimes call it evidence based too.
Oh, that's nice. Big. But you know, the overall question of Moneyball was, can you just boil it down to a principle? And the principle was, you have to have more runs than other teams altogether.
Yeah.
There are so many games that you can lose a game and it's not the end of the world. It's not like football where it's what, 12 games, 13 games?
Yeah, football's really tough. The stochastic fluctuations in football are much more irritating because you have a smaller sample size.
But every team's going to lose a third of its games and every team's going to win a third of its games. And it's winning the other third that's like a mess in the middle, as many of those as possible, that makes you a champion.
Yeah.
And so just thinking of it in terms of runs that, you know, this person's going to score this many times in a season, and then building a team out of this high scoring kind of thing, as opposed to the magic or, you know, God, this guy can hit like hell. It's like, yeah, but how many runs does he score? Yeah. So that's a principle.
Yeah.
Right, that you could use to organize how you approach everything about baseball, which is a very simple game where you hit the ball, you throw the ball, you catch the ball, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I'm quoting? No, you don't.
Who are you quoting when you do that?
It's okay, I'm going to leave it alone.
Was that from Moneyball?
No, that was from a different movie. It's from the best baseball movie.
Field of Dreams?
For the love
of the game?
There are two kinds of people. They're the people who know that Bull Durham is the best baseball movie.
And oh, I've seen Bull Durham. I just haven't seen it in a while.
Yeah.
It's not the best baseball movie.
I will stab you in the head.
But similarly, so...
Wait, let me close my loop and then you can take it farther. Because let me get away from Bull Durham and baseball.
Okay.
Where once I just kind of consumed... Rah, 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 rah,
Kevin rah, Costner rah. Said that in Bull Durham, did he not?
Yeah. And then... And then the coach kind of takes it and turns it into a screaming motivational speech. What does that make them? Lollygaggers. So the...
Again with that fancy jargon of yours.
I used to just suck it up and just... I read that. Yeah, this happens in it. Or, I watched that movie. That was so cool. But these days, I watch so many fewer movies, and I read so many fewer books than I ever used to. But I read them with intent, you know, and I try to pull pieces out of them to use, even when it's like just emotional
in your life, in your analysis of the world.
Yeah, and I feel like that's the process of educating. Is you know, I did a very crap job with my education. I had to kind of redo it myself, looking back at what I should have done and reading about education since I was working at a school. Like, if I didn't work at Georgia Tech, I never would have gotten
to the
place.
You'd be homeless living in a cardboard box. That's, I'm going with that one.
I would definitely be somebody's roommate and still smoking and drinking a lot.
Okay. I can believe that. But so when I watch movies, I find some of the best wisdom will summarize the way the world works out of movies. And there's really just one scene out of The American President with Michael Douglas and Annette Bening.
That's one of your favorites.
It's one of my favorites that summarizes the entire electoral strategy of all politicians, all of them. And he gives a speech when he finally realized, look, he should be including handguns in his gun bill, and he should really send this environmental bill to the floor. And he analyzed his opponent's strategy, who was played by Richard Dreyfuss, mm-hmm. extremely well, big fan of Richard Dreyfuss. And Michael Douglas said, you know, you gather a group of, you know, middle-aged, middle-income voters who remember, you know, with a feeling of longing, a simpler time. And you pick one issue and you say, that's to blame for their problem. And you flash it on TV and you convince them. And this is all we do now in these things. You say, I mean, what is Trump saying, Hillary? She's unfit. She's not healthy. She's mentally insane. She's corrupt. They're just flashing things at you. Relevant, true, significant enough, it's irrelevant.
I heard a definition.
And he goes, and that's how you win elections. Yeah. Absolutely.
Recently, I heard a definition of politics that blew my mind and is the complementary and contrasting thought to what you just said. Politics is bringing together a coalition of incredibly disparate people who disagree on everything except one issue. Mm-hmm. And then making change based on that one issue.
That's a good definition.
Yeah.
Actually, politics is not a dirty word. That was told to me by Richard Bark of Georgia Tech, who works in policy. Politics is the way you get stuff done when you don't agree on things.
Yeah.
So it's not necessarily bad. And this, I think, I'm sure Matthew and Mike do it. They probably do it in a different way than I do. But yesterday I was trying to teach my students problem-solving skills. They're not interested in that. They're interested in the 11 formulas from chapters 2, 3, and 4 that they can memorize and understand how to apply.
Who taught them that, do you think? And I don't mean taught them the formulas. I'm saying, like,
I don't know where they get that. Not all of them got this. And it would be so easy to blame it on K through 12. But increasingly, the teachers in K through 12 are doing great pedagogical approaches. That's what I get for using a fancy word. The way they teach.
They teach great.
They have open-ended classes. They have discussion-based thing. They have experiential learning. They're doing a much better job, so we need to do the same thing. And so I do give them homework to practice some of these calculations. Some of it is practice.
I think all it takes is one semester for a student to go one way or the other. They take one semester where that they were like, man, I blew the test in this class, and I nailed the test in this class, and I got an A versus a C. It's clearly all about just get to the test and figure out how to take that. Yeah.
But then I'm doing what some of my colleagues like Joe Ledoux do is I give them an open-ended problem. And instead of giving some big chemical process, I give them a hairdryer about which I know very little, being follically challenged. And I said, you know, calculate some flow rates and some mass flow rates, very simple calculations that a chemical engineer would do. But then I didn't give them certain parameters. So the gas expands. So they needed to know the inlet and the outlet temperature. And I just said it was a hairdryer on high heat. And I want them to look at it. And I say, you know, first draw a picture, a diagram of what this is. And then start thinking about the variables that you know and the variables that you'd like to know. And one of the variables they need to calculate the variables that I want them to calculate would be the temperature. And they skipped right over that. They're like, what's the formula? What do we do? And then we finally took a pause because my teaching assistants noticed this, which is good. We got them engaged. And then I said, well, where do you get those temperatures? And they're so used to either they're given to them or they don't need to know it. This is not how you solve problems. Problems
are
big, wild, and woolly, open-ended things. So I said, well, what temperature do you want? Somebody goes, 25. Okay, that's a standard state. We often assume that. Is this room 25 degrees? And people eventually realize, no, 25 is kind of warm. A typical air conditioning room might be 22, 23. And then someone said 20. And he said it with such confidence, I said, good, let's use 20. So you're making the assumption we're in a well-air-conditioned room. Totally reasonable. Pick a number.
So what I'm hearing is that you basically gave them
They're
an
assignment.
They're
scared to death to make an assumption.
But you gave them an assignment that had no...
No one single answer.
No answer.
Yeah.
But also, like, it didn't even have a question.
Yeah, I actually asked them some questions. I wanted to calculate certain things. And then I said, well, what about the outlet temperature? And don't look at me because I haven't used a hairdryer since the early 80s.
Okay, so if there were questions based in, but what you did was you did not say, if a train leaves this place traveling right. 65
and
miles
you know
an
the
hour,
initial velocity of one and the vector of the other, blah, blah, blah.
Hour, when do they meet in the middle of a 120-mile track? You said, hey, I want to find out these things about this stuff. What have you got?
Hit it.
How did it go?
It went very well. It was very satisfying. And in the end, I said, well, we were discussing this. What's the outlet temperature? And they're like, I'm like, you live in the information age. Can someone please Google outlet temperature of a hairdryer? And they were all between about 55 and 66, and we assumed 60, and we were done in 5 minutes. But they're paralyzed with fear because we give them these little puzzles where there's one answer and you have all the information. Whereas I put the information on the front exam and say, this is information you may or may not need. Sometimes I give them stuff they don't need. And they're like, well, they give us the heat capacity. We must have to use that. No. That's why I always include some arcane fact like, you know, my age or shoe size, so they realize, oh, we might not need all of these.
You're a monster.
Indeed I am.
Consilience with Pete and Charlie is a podcast about the intersection of science and the humanities.
What happened to the unity of knowledge, dude?
That's at the beginning. This is at the end.
Oh, okay.
Thanks for listening to Consilience with Pete and Charlie. You can find us on Facebook. You can like our page, share our episode announcements. Follow us on Twitter. You can find us on Tumblr, too. Pete and Charlie, we're all over the internet.
And what does the Georgia Institute of Technology and WRIK Atlanta think of the content of Consilience?
Hopefully, they'll never find out.